Jimmy Walsh. Friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. You may be listening to us in any corner or cubbyhole throughout the world, since we are simulcasting our program on irishradio.com. We are delighted to link up with and to welcome Joe Cahillan, who is the CEO of Concern Worldwide. And Dr. Joe Cahillan, you're indeed you're very welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be here, Adrian. Thanks for having me. I must confess to having a little moisture in my eyes because my father hails from Tipperary, so the song you just played is a very familiar and emotional one for me.
We have a research department here, second to none.
Good morning.
And it's called the Happenstance Department.
It's very effective.
I do want to, before we speak about Concern, I suppose your own story of growing up in what many would have figured in a privileged setting is one that I know will be of interest to people who haven't heard your story. I mean, you might run a bias again.
Okay, I'll try to net it all out. My parents, as I just mentioned in my father's case, both emigrated from Ireland. My father from Tipperary, my mother from Cavan, and they didn't know each other. They met here, but my mother got a job as a live-in maid in Rye, New York, wealthy suburb of New York City, and my father as a gardener in a nearby town, Porchester, and somehow they met. And the family that my mother lived with were very generous and good to her. He was a very successful banker, and when she announced that she was marrying this bloke from Tipperary, that he wanted, the man she worked for wanted to meet my father. And they hit it off, and he offered to get my father a job at the bank on Wall Street. My father had no education, but they manufactured, I think, a job as the greeter at the bank. My father would open the door and get people where they were going.
Yeah.
And he was a very affable, outgoing man, as you might suspect, given his lineage. And one of the wealthy customers some years into this job asked my father if he would move in to his mansion, and I don't use the word mansion lightly, on 79th Street and 5th Avenue, one of the elite neighborhoods in New York City and maybe in the world. And so we moved into this mansion and looked after it for the better part of 25 years. So we grew up in the lap of luxury,
right,
as I like to say, through the kindness of two strangers, the banker and the bank customer, that both did my father and therefore me an enormous favor.
Now, having said that, you also you didn't grow up as spoiled brats. It was always part of the ethos of your parents that one would not learn how to appreciate what was there, but great emphasis, if I remember correctly, on education and getting ahead. So it wasn't like you were had your feet up all day every day in the lab.
No, my goodness, I had all sorts of odd jobs. You're triggering. I walked dogs. I worked in a Jewish delicatessen on Madison Avenue. I delivered radios and televisions all my life, all my youthful life. And you're right, though, Aidan. My parents were, as many, many immigrant populations are, they were so focused on their children, my sister and I, and in education. And because of the neighborhood I grew up in, I went to St. Ignatius Loyola School, which is a Jesuit, one of a rare few, actually, Jesuit grade schools. Elementary schools, and once the Jesuits got a hold of me, it was Jesuit high school, Jesuit college.
Yeah, I had a period with the Jesuits too, and I knew some of us, either them or I, should immigrate. So, you know, they had the numbers and I didn't, so hence I wound up in New York. But they, in fairness, though, to the, you know, to the Catholic schools, which are, as we know, under very severe threat, and which is a totally separate topic, but we, many of us, I think, are inclined when we speak of priests and nuns and the Catholic school system, we're inclined to paint the image of a bunch of warriors, you know, the Cromwellian type of approach to education. And I think it might be, you know, it as we look around at the success of those who attended the Catholic schools on both sides of the Atlantic, we could, you know, we could get rid of the tongue in cheek and say that whatever they did, it did produce a great a system of education and appreciation for, you know, for what life actually lays ahead for most people, for most of us.
Yeah, there's no question, Adrian. And, you know, I remind my children that even though, you know, I actually taught my father to read, so I came from a family with, you know, virtually no education, but it never occurred to me once I got into the kind clutches of the Jesuits, it yeah. never occurred to me that I wouldn't go to college. It was mm-hmm. never a choice. I just assumed that was going to be part of my life, and think of all the people that don't, you know, that struggle to get that opportunity. So
absolutely.
I feel very, very, very fortunate and blessed.
What career did you pursue, and how did you come to choose?
I majored in journalism at Fordham University, mm-hmm. and I started out in journalism. I never was an on-air person like you, but I wrote news for WNEW Radio, a radio station in New
York. Indeed, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I was a copy boy before that at CBS TV News. And I did some reporting for the New York Times, all of this as a very young man. And then I went off to Vietnam, which is another whole story, but came back intent on doing work in the political arena or in education. And I took a job as a manager of public affairs, government relations, that sort of thing, for an educational publishing group. It was owned by a company called Xerox. And I thought I'd be there for 2 years. And one thing led to another, and I found myself running the philanthropy for Xerox and the community relations and things that were attractive to me, and a political and social environment that was nurturing and good for me. And so I stayed there. And then I came to Concern because the Xerox Foundation, which I was president of, started supporting the work of Concern about a decade ago. And that's how I eventually landed at Concern.
Concern, and there are, you know, great organizations that were founded in Ireland and continue to do great work throughout the world. But Concern, the story of Concern itself is an interesting one in the sense that, you know, back in 1968, and a period of time when, you know, Ireland was still exporting many of its own citizens to, you know, who were both, basically, even at that point, there had to be an awareness that the majority of people growing up in Ireland were actually grown for export. That sounds tough, but the truth of the matter is that Ireland, you know, coming through the 50s, you know, the 40s, the 50s, 60s did not provide the type of opportunity for most people who were growing up. So it was pretty much, it was no surprise that somebody should emigrate. Somebody should go somewhere. And in fact, most immigrants had this vision that from once you immigrated, you know, there was that hope that you would either make money or make progress and return to Ireland. What we had, though, during that period and for long before, the missioner and the missioner from Ireland did not even, you know, contemplate a return to Ireland. If you were to see a missioner either in the clerical area, in either as a priest or a nun, and you went to the missions, that was it. That was not a return trip. And we had built the Irish had built a tremendous legacy even then in bringing, you know, our missionaries and sending them throughout the world. Is that one of the safer starting points, safer concern, when without any massive philanthropy, no philanthropy, but the, say, Angus Finucane, Father Angus Finucane and his brother, you know, Jack, Father Jack, down in Limerick, somehow founded, you know, a new concept of mission, and contrary to what many of us, particularly growing up in Ireland, were of the opinion that from once missionaries went abroad, you know, that they were treading softly but carrying that big stick to make, you know, not only Christians but Catholics, you know, out of people in again the poorest areas. Would that have been interpreted as such here, or was you were growing up here? Would that have been somewhere in the mix?
Very much so. I mean, there was one. I couldn't tell you how he was related, but there was a missionary in the family, an Irish-born man. By then, his first name to me was Father. I guess he had a middle name, but it was Father Heaney. He would arrive in New York perhaps every third year, and it was akin to the recent Pope's visit in the family. He was a hero of you know, extraordinary width and height, and he would come from, you know, one year he was coming from Trinidad and another year from Rwanda with, you know, tales of the missions and larger than life character. So yeah, I think the churches here, as I recall, were always raising money for the Irish mission. So I think we were very, very aware of this part of the Irish heritage. The Finucanes that you mentioned were were, now I may be wrong on my history, you know, it gets a little fuzzy, but to me, I would say that they were very ecumenical and maybe at the leading edge of the ecumenical movement within the Catholic Church. So they were much more focused on, dare I say, on saving lives than saving souls. Not that they didn't care about both, but the emphasis in their work was on, you know, providing life-saving, life-transforming help to the, as you put it, to the poorest of the poor.
Right. Concern would grow perhaps more rapidly than some of the other NGOs, but it seemed like it was a fearless response to wherever hunger and trouble and war corruption in government, which dribbled down and had pretty much the same effect and result that we see today. And I think that perhaps the influence of concern indeed changed the course of history in far flung places that you can't even find on a map.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned Biafra was the beginning, and Biafra was a state that never made it, that split off from Nigeria during the Civil War. And the Finucane brothers were there at the time, and famine set in, and the situation was just deplorable and horrific. And they, it's very interesting, Adrian, they were such optimists, the Finucanes, and they just assumed that they could somehow help these people. And they appealed to the Irish because of our own famine.
Mm-hmm.
And money started to come to buy food. And I think in the space of months, if I'm not mistaken, but a very brief period of time, the Finucane brothers, the Finucane priests who were siblings to one another,
right,
and Concern had an airplane.
Yeah.
They bought an airplane, and it made flights every night into Biafra, landing on a field under threat of fire. They used to tell stories about training the young Biafran boys to run out with candles to line the runway once they heard that the plane was approaching. They could hear it, and they would land and then douse the candles so that the army couldn't come and disrupt them, and they had to fill the runways with potholes from bombing every couple of times a week. And they just had this enormous optimism that if they were on the right side of things, that the resources would come. And even today, like in a place like Syria or South Sudan or the Central African Republic, concern kind of goes when the situation erupts on the expectation, I was going to say hope, but
yeah,
it's more the expectation that the resources will somehow materialize. And they do.
Let me ask you, the scope and the common definition of what concern does. Again, many cases going back to, getting a plane and dropping off food, regardless of the risk that would have brought. Concern does more than the food drops and all of which is very important, significant, and the first thing is people don't have anything to eat. That's a good place to start. But concern developed into something unique in terms of in the introduction I was saying that Concern has implemented programs 29 countries reaching 7.5 million people. Concern does not make the quick hit, whereas that is tremendous and taking nothing away from many of the other organizations. But Concern reacts to crises, but they have a tendency to hang on even when the immediacy is taken care of.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right, Adrian. The only word, if I may correct the master, just to make a point, you're absolutely right. You said that there's a tendency to stay on, and I would say there's an absolute commitment to stay on. But you're absolutely right. I'll give you a great example that I think people can respond to that typifies a lot about concern, and it was the earthquake in Nepal about a year and a half ago now.
Yes.
It's classic of the way we operate. We chose to go within Nepal. I'm sorry. I'm conflating two things. I'm talking about actually the Philippine problem a year and a half ago. But we chose to go within the Philippines to the worst place where nobody was heading. And it was an island that had a small fishing economy, these two-man boats that went out and fished and fed the family and sold the extra fish for a few pennies to help with the family. And we chose this island because the fishing fleet of 2,000 boats had been completely destroyed by the tsunami. And so we did exactly what you're saying. The initial thing was to feed these people, to provide them with clean water, to get them shelter. But within months, we were loaning the 2,000 fishermen half the cost of a new boat and giving them half the cost of a new boat so that they could get back to where they were and stand on their own feet. And we had some resources left over, and we hired somebody, it's something we know nothing about, to restore the coral that was essential to the continuation of the fish supply off the island shore. And we've virtually left now that project. But you're right. The first thing are the essentials: food, water, shelter, latrines, hygiene. But as soon as we can, it turns to how can we help these people have a sustainable life and income without us. And we're all about, we love to say that our mission is to work ourselves out of a job, to go into a community and help raise it up, help the people raise themselves up, really, and then leave knowing that they're on the road to a better life.
I think also, if we go back to the early days and maybe the first couple of decades of the history of concern, it was something many of us had to learn slowly, and that is that to take care of crises obviously is extremely important, but the notion that we would educate, help, support people, who were going to be in the same situation very shortly after the current crisis had passed. That was new. That was, and it was a massive undertaking. And so that would bring us to, well, where are the bodies? How do you, build an organization that somehow, 50 plus years later develops into, an organization that knows no end, while you are, again, helping and creating a great legacy in terms of having people help themselves. How do you respond? Why is it that concern is on the ready? You don't know where the next disaster is about to occur, but somehow the response is there. Can you tell us a little bit about the structure of concern, and how did it get to be, and how is it, one of the most significant organizations aiding the poorest in the world?
Yeah, well, it's a great question, Adrian, and I think again it goes back to the Finucanes and the ethos that they established in the organization. And a couple of the things that were very important to them was that concern would not try to go into communities with solutions. You know, the old thing,
right.
to a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm.
That the way we approach our work is to really work with communities and find out what they want, what they feel they need to lift themselves out of poverty.
And again, with the emphasis being on what is practical, you can't go into an area that doesn't have clean water and decide that, that the sky's the limit and you can build schools and you can build hospitals or you can, approach it that way. But, again, how you determine when you go into an area as to what the possibilities are there. And I'm sure in many of those areas, the art of survival does not open up great planning or expectation about where do we go from here.
Yeah, but you'd be surprised about what people know. It brings tears to my eyes, but I remember being in Liberia dedicating a well that we had built for a little village that had never had clean water. There was no English spoken. They were cut off entirely from the world. I was there literally 2 days after President Obama was elected president for his first term, and these people had no notion of who he was or really even probably what America was. And they got this well, and then the village elder asked through a translator if Concern could do one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that he wanted in this little tiny, cut off from the world village, was a teacher. So people do know what the levers are that can change their lives, especially if you're willing to really, I call it, listen hard to what they're trying to tell you. They may not have the language to convey exactly what the need is, but they do know that it translates into better hygiene or education. Or better ways of farming, or it varies by
right.
community, but people do tend to know. And so, you also hit on something else, Adrian. Though that there's no Concern believes this deeply. There's no one solution. So in a community, it can't be just build a school. It has to be provide better health care or a better means for people to make money to support the school that provides the education. You know, these
right.
things are very interrelated, and you can't really achieve change without looking at the broader picture. And I think we're very good at that. And we're the other thing I would say that really has helped us grow is that there's an old expression that great things can happen if nobody cares who gets the credit.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's part of the Finucane ethos that Concern is never after getting the credit; it's getting results. And people who help us, the aid organizations like USAID here or Irish Aid in
right.
Ireland, they respect us for that. And so when a crisis happens and we jump in with both feet, we're always pretty confident that these organizations will have our back and will come along with resources. We have I'm brand new, so I'm not so brand new anymore, but I'm with Concern 2.5 years as the CEO. So this is not my doing. I really do stand on the shoulders of a lot of great people that went before me, but we have a tremendous reputation in the area that we work in, with governments, with big donors. We get a lot of money from the Gates Foundation, the
yeah.
Kellogg Foundation. So we really do enjoy a great and well-earned reputation for what we do.
One of my guest friends is Dr. Joe Cahalan, and who is CEO of Concern Worldwide. I just want to ask you, though, if you could separate for us a common myth and that is that we look at America and we look at Ireland, we look at countries who actually, do provide tremendous aid and food and water, and who respond very much to natural disasters, war-torn areas. And we sometimes maybe are critical of countries and those who in fact do a great job, but we're very quick to say, they have all of this excess food packaging that they come and they drop it off, and then that's the end of that deal. Are we inclined to dismiss the generosity of, say, of countries and those who actually do great work and make those provisions?
Oh, I think your question is absolutely right. It sort of has the answer that I would be the first to say that there's a lot of waste in development work and in humanitarian aid.
That's the word I was looking for, by the way.
you could say that about most things. You know, I worked for a large corporation that was very well run, but God knows, not perfectly. You know, there's no such thing, and there is corruption in our field, and we'd be fools not to say that. But it gets, as does most bad news, you would be the first to know, it gets blown out of proportion. There are probably some bad actors, and there are definitely some bad things that happen in countries. We work in Haiti, and we do some fabulous work, but it has an enormous amount of corruption. I can tell you that we are extraordinarily vigilant about it. One of the reasons we get the support we get from the U.S. government and the Irish government is that if we have a whiff of corruption, we tell our donors immediately that we think something is going on and we're going to get to the bottom of it and invite them in to help us get to the bottom of it. But it's one of the things that that angers me, and I can't do anything about it, and I understand it. But when something happens that's bad, CNN is there within an hour to cover it, and you never get the coverage of all the fabulous stuff that aid organizations do, not just us, but other great organizations. So it's like any facet, I guess, of our lives. There's good and bad in everything. We can say that about our own Catholic Church. You know, it's had its problems.
Absolutely.
But it does enormous good in the world as well. So, but it's a real it is a problem, because when something goes wrong, some people do want to judge the whole. Now, but I should say, Adrian, I think I may have said this on your show before, but it's such a wonderful thing. Statistically, the Irish are the most generous people in the world.
Yep.
On a per capita basis, the Irish give more than anyone. And they give a lot of it outside the country. They give a lot of it to organizations like Concern.
Let me ask you about the Global Hunger Index, the watchdog, as it were, and I'm sure you can expand on that, but, like, who's watching overall and who's watching the progress or lack thereof of how effective aid going into places, third world countries, how it's actually operating, and who are the members of the Global Hunger Index, the organization?
Well, we're we're a leader in it. We're one of two or three partners with a research arm that does the work for us. But it's in its 10th year. And what it looks at is ranking countries in the developing world. We look at several things like child malnutrition, mm-hmm. Stunting, child mortality, and hunger, and put all these indices together to rank countries so that we know, and so the aid community and governments know which countries are doing better than others and why. So we do a lot of case studies to help figure out why. Countries like Rwanda, who had this, as you will, we all right. remember, horrible genocide 20 years ago, and Ethiopia, with its incredible history of famine, are actually doing extremely well on this global hunger index. They've mm-hmm. risen dramatically in the last decade. Places like South Sudan and Central African Republic have sunk lower, in Chad and other countries. But it's a way of tracking how the world is doing about and what the world is doing about hunger, so that so it's a measuring stick and draws attention to yeah. the problem once a year. Now, having said that, the hunger index has improved by 27% in the last couple of decades. So there has been great improvement and less hunger in the world, but I dare say it's all a relative term, because there are still almost a billion people, one out of nine, who go hungry in the world. They live on less than $1.25 a day. And we know why. And this year, the Hunger Index, for the first time, and I'm really thrilled about it, is drawing a link between hunger and war. War is by far the biggest cause of hunger, because people, farmers mm-hmm. and people and communities get disrupted. It's in last year, we don't have 2015 figures yet, but last year, Adrian, 13 million people were uprooted by violence. That's 42,000 people a day fled their homes last year because of conflict and war. And at no time in our history, in our recorded history, have there been more refugees and displaced people on this planet. There's nearly, I think the figure is 57 million. It's shy of 60 million, but wow. not by much. Yeah. People well, who yeah. were out of their homes because of war. And if they wind up in refugee camps, as most will, they're likely to spend an average of, I can hardly say this figure, 17 years in those camps. So they lose a generation wow. of the family mm. and the community. And so this link between war and hunger, we're hoping to shed some light on it. Then we'll be having a conference tomorrow about it, actually at the UN, the Irish Mission to the United Nations
yes, indeed.
Is hosting us.
And very significant, you know, again, much maligned, you know, the United Nations and a great number of people would say that, you know, there's a lot of spinning of wheels that comes out of the United Nations, and that's easy, I suppose, for many of us who really don't know that whatever shortcomings or failings the United Nations has, that's one area where if they weren't doing it, it's not like somebody else is chapping at the bit to take over. Can I ask you just about Syria? Syria as we know it, if we go back as little as 5 years ago, Syria was doing very nicely, thank you.
Yes.
It was, in many ways, not unlike Ireland, or take any of the countries that had indeed a fairly vibrant middle class, and as such, you know, talk about pulling the short straw, that because of war, because of chaos, here it is, a country that is actually destined for migrants, and that doesn't look like it's going to get cured anytime soon.
No, and there's a perfect example of war. But you're quite right. You always steal part of my answer when you ask me the question because you know so much about this. But Syria did have a middle class, and I don't think people generally recognize that. So the people who were refugees from Syria are, you know, there are all sorts of people, but they include accountants and teachers and healthcare professionals and everybody. But you're right, it's 5 years in, 300,000 people dead, 7 million displaced within the country, and another 4 million have left the country. One figure that always impresses me is that 1 million refugees from Syria are in Lebanon and now account for 25% of the Lebanese population. One in four people in Lebanon is now a Syrian refugee. So it's and 2 million more in Turkey. We're doing work in Turkey and in Lebanon and in northern Syria along the borders, and exactly the kind of stuff that we've already talked about: water, food, shelter, getting ready for the winter. People don't realize that there are harsh winters in that part of the world, but at the same time, running schools and helping with sanitation, building latrines, trying to find people more permanent shelter. So we're all over it. In fact, we anticipate that by the end of the year, we'll be able to say that that we have touched in some positive way 1 million Syrian refugees living along those borders.
Okay.
So a huge problem. And I think you said it. I just bears repeating that it's not. Doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon, because the answer to it fundamentally, as this global hunger index is pointing out, the answer is peace. The answer is resolving the conflict. But it's, as you well know too, there, it's not like putting two people in the room. It's like there are 20 sides. It seems like fighting it out in Syria.
Which brings us to again. Concern worldwide, and the tremendous advances made in the organization, concern worldwide, U.S. and many of us would take for granted that everybody should know the dedication of one Tom Moran, who is the chairman of Concern Worldwide in the U.S. and also, as we know, chairman, president, CEO of Mutual of America, and the significance of that in the United States in terms of involving not just fundraising but involving a great number of people who may be of the opinion that this one is so out of control, so big, that there really isn't that much we can do about it other than, you know, say a prayer for them and wish them well.
Right. I'm glad you brought up Tom Moran, who is and has been the heart and soul of Concern in the United States. He and Mutual have been involved from the very beginning, and Tom is an extraordinary, as you know, leader and salesman. I love to tell the story, which is absolutely true, that if Tom Moran gives you his business card, one side of it will say Thomas J. Moran, President, CEO, and Chairman, Mutual of America. No longer president, by the way.
Yes.
And if you flip it over, it says Thomas J. Moran, Chairman, Concern Worldwide, U.S., and all the phone numbers and emails attendant to it. So he's he is in with 150% of his commitment. He makes the case, as we all do, that no, we can't solve all the world's problems, but we can solve some of them. and we have an obligation and a responsibility to try to do that. And he also makes the point, which I very much subscribe to, that at its root, an organization like CERN, it may be the biggest benefit of all, is that by doing what we do, we communicate to people in the worst situations possible that they're not alone, that somebody from outside knows of their circumstance, cares about it, and wants to do something to help them improve their lives. And that's an enormous contribution. So it's not just about money, which is important to our work,
right,
but it's also about just being part of the community that says, hey, we can't solve it all, but damn it, we're going to do what we can.
Yeah. The Seeds of Hope annual award dinner is, you know, it's coming up on Tuesday, December 1st. It's at the Waldorf Astoria here in New York. And this year's honoree is also has his roots, like the Finucanes, in Limerick. And one of the most successful businessmen ever to come out of Ireland. He's the president and chief executive officer of, well, it's now Northwell Health, but it'll take us at least a generation to accept that North Shore Long Island Jewish Healthcare Center, the largest conglomerate of healthcare facility, you know, east of the Mississippi. Let me just ask you about this particular dinner, because if we look at the dinner committee, there are some of the most significant successful heads of massive corporations in the United States are part of this, which again might say, well, you know, there you are. That's what I was telling you. What can we do in becoming part of something that is so enormous and so fruitful in terms of the work being done?
Well, to have grown as much as we've grown and to be as successful as we are, we need support from all segments of our society and at all levels. So yes, we get big money from the government and from big foundations and from corporations, but we get a lot of money from people that give us $5 and $10 and $25 and $50 donations, and it all adds up. And oftentimes somebody who's giving me a check for $25 is making a larger sacrifice than someone who's giving me a check for $100,000.
Right.
You know, it's according to means. But if I can plug, I would really encourage people to go on our website, which is concernusa.org.
Right.
And you can find out all sorts of information about us, some great stories about the work that we're doing, and ways to help, including for some of your listeners coming to the Seeds of Hope dinner at the Waldorf Astoria. My parents mm-hmm. would roll over to think of me there on the stage to support the dinner, but also all sorts of ways to support us. And even if people just want to learn about what we do, that would be enormously helpful, so that they can maybe tell some of their friends about our work.
By the way, the person I was referring to is Mike Dowling, Michael J. Dowling, who's the president and chief executive officer, again, of Northwell Health, North Shore LIJ, and somebody who's his level of success in healthcare indeed has and his own mission an involvement in, and again, bringing the success of that healthcare organization and spreading that to many areas that we've spoken about. That's a great choice. And again, the Seeds of Hope dinner, friends, the annual award dinner, is taking place on Tuesday, December 1st. It is at the Waldorf Astoria. But I think you're right. And I want to thank you, you know, for joining us this morning and filling us in on giving us a great overview of concern. But I think that for those who would really like to know more and to follow not only the history but the current influence of concern worldwide, you're right. Let's go to the website, www.concernusa.org. And indeed, a toll-free number, 1-800-59-CONCERN, C-O-N-C-E-R-N, would, indeed, that's another way to access information. And there are two headquarters, there are many others, but the headquarters in New York is actually right in Manhattan. The telephone number there, 212-557-8000, and in Chicago, it is 312-431-8400. Dr. Joe Callahan, thank you for joining us and also for giving us a very good and clear picture of concern and its significance throughout the poorest areas of the world and how it's doing its job. There is, I'd like to, now that we're running somewhat behind the 11 o'clock news from Ireland, I would like to also point out that, yes, there's room for those who would like to assist in some way. Not just in money, but or the level of contribution, but also to get involved in a massive world organization that does what it set out to do back in 1968.
Adrian, thanks so much for having me.
And again, thank you. My guest friend is Dr. Joseph Callahan, CEO of Concern Worldwide. Thanks a lot. Okay, Joe.
Bye-bye.
And friends, you're listening to Irish Radio, Irish Radio Network, USA. And again, the massive work of Concern continues a tradition, and I think we heard Dr. Joe Callahan there telling us something which is fact. Ireland, per capita, the most generous country in the world in terms of supporting, the poorest of the poor, something that we are and should be very proud of, the Irish, and of course, in the United States and in North America playing its part as well. Friends, you're listening to WVNJ 1160 AM, Oakland, New York, Oakland, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut. You may be listening to us indeed on or through irishradio.com worldwide. Let's go to Kevin O'Connor. And Kevin, thank you for waiting for us to bring us the news and sports from Ireland. What's going on?